From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a former Michigan governor gets tapped as Joe Biden's nominee for energy secretary.
When she signed the clean energy law in 2008, that laid the groundwork for what we've seen today in terms of clean energy in Michigan.
Also, a Detroit native and songwriter talks about filling the yawning spaces opened by the pandemic.
All the things coming at us this year, it's a blessing and a curse for creative types, you know, for songwriters, for artists. I don't know how this doesn't affect the art you make.
And news anchor Devin Scillian's secret life as a best-selling children's book author and his resistance to sequels.
Coming up with a successful and satisfying story is a better idea, and then a message tends to reveal itself.
Those stories and more coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later on the show, we'll be talking with WDIV news anchor Devin Scillian, who moonlights as a successful children's book author. That's later in the program, but first, Joe Biden's proposed cabinet is getting a boost of Midwestern expertise. We learned late yesterday that former two-term Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm is Biden's pick for energy secretary. If confirmed, she'll take over from outgoing Secretary Dan Bruyette. Granholm's time at the helm was not a particularly easy road. From 2003 to 2011, she had to make decisions about the Great Recession, education reform, and weather endless dust-ups with a Republican-controlled legislature over the state budget. Biden says he believes Granholm's experience with the auto industry is what he needs to move America further away from its dependence on fossil fuels. Liz Boyd was communications director when Jennifer Granholm was governor and now runs Liz Boyd Public Relations. Liz, welcome to Stateside.
Hello, nice to be with you.
So you've known the governor a long time. Were you surprised by this news? For that matter, was she surprised?
Well, I was surprised and I wasn't surprised. I mean, the governor has had a long relationship with the vice president. She has the experience that he's looking for with his team. You know, his motto, it's all about building back better. And who better to help him do that than Jennifer Granholm?
Have you spoken with her since the news broke?
I have.
How did she sound?
Well, you know, certainly, you know, nothing can be confirmed until the Biden administration confirms it and makes a formal announcement. But I think the governor would welcome the opportunity to serve and to bring her expertise and her passion to that office and to that position in the cabinet.
You know, a great deal of DOE's work involves a rather unsexy prospect, maintaining the United States nuclear arsenal. Not perhaps very glamorous, but incredibly important, and one requiring a specific skill set. I mean, would Jennifer Granholm be a better fit for something like the Department of Labor, given her time talking and working with the automobile industry and being a Democrat from Michigan? Why DOE?
Well, I think that's a question for the Biden team to answer. But I will tell you that having watched her serve for, as you said, two terms as Michigan's governor, I've seen how she can tackle problems. I see how she's very methodical in being an administrator, being very hands-on. And so, as you say, this is a very important, critical piece of the job in terms of maintaining the nuclear arsenal. And who better to be in that position than someone who's trustworthy, who's into detail, who will ensure that the job is done right. I mean, there'll be no question as to whether the job is being done. And I think in the last 4 years, we've seen that it's always the case.
Michigan's Senate Majority Leader, Mike Shirky, came out right away to criticize this choice and tweeted about the many job losses in Michigan during Granholm's administration, which, we should repeat, coincided with the Great Recession. Do you think that this could make her confirmation difficult for her, the fact that so many people remember her associated with those years?
Well, first of all, I think the notion that the Senate Majority Leader is tweeting and criticizing the former governor is a little ironic, and I'll let it go at that. But I think it's important to note that when Jennifer Granholm was governor, the state of Michigan was so fortunate that she was the governor. You have to remember that in the 2 years prior to her election, and she was elected in 2002, but prior to her election, Michigan had already lost nearly 200,000 jobs, many of which were being outsourced in large numbers to countries like China and Mexico. Washington had failed to adopt a pro-American manufacturing policy agenda, even in the face of huge manufacturing losses. Michigan's budget was in crisis. Tax cuts adopted by the previous administration were rolling in, and I could go on and on, so I won't do that. But clearly, she had her hands full. And I think you have to look at what she accomplished during that time. I mean, she worked to diversify the economy. You know, we used to laugh, but it was her motto, and she lived by it, was that she would go anywhere, do anything to bring jobs to Michigan. And she did. She had the 21st Century Jobs Fund, which was the most aggressive effort in the country at that time to attract advanced battery manufacturers and R&D companies. We had the most successful retraining program through No Worker Left Behind, a program that was designed to help people get the skills they needed for the jobs that were available. I always remember Jennifer Granholm saying, "We're not going to educate you to get a degree in political science and French like she did in college. We were going to give them the education they needed so they could get a job." And that was so important. And I think the other thing that people need to remember is that during that entire time of economic transition, which obviously went way beyond the state of Michigan, we protected families. We made sure that people were not thrown off the social safety net. And that was critical at that time. So, I mean, there's a lot of good that gets swept under the rug, because, you know, the headline is always, well, the economy was bad. Well, the economy was bad, but we dealt with it. And I think you have to look at what she did when she signed the clean energy law in 2008. I mean, that laid the groundwork for what we've seen today in terms of clean energy in Michigan. I mean, nobody can drive up 127 going north and not see those wind turbines in Gratiot County. I mean, I think an awful lot of what's happening in Michigan today, the jobs that are happening in Michigan today, is the direct result of her leadership in clean energy back when she was in office.
A lot of times when we've seen Jennifer Granholm's face lately, it's been on CNN when she's sort of dabbled in the world of punditry. Do you think it will be easy enough for her to get back into public administration and government?
Oh, I think so. I mean, the governor has done, done so much in the years since she left office. I mean, she spent a number of years working with the Pew Clean Energy Program. She has been a visiting professor at Berkeley in California, where she did her undergraduate work. Yes, she's been on CNN, but why wouldn't CNN or any network want Jennifer Granholm to be commenting on events of the day? So I think this would be no problem for her. I think she'll welcome it if it comes to be. And I certainly hope that the Republican Senate, if it is a Republican Senate, would confirm her without question.
So looking a little bit more broadly at the cabinet, President-elect Biden has also tapped Pete Buttigieg for Secretary of Transportation. He's a Michigan-adjacent pick. And he's also chosen Congresswoman Marsha Fudge of Ohio to lead Housing and Urban Development. This is quite the showing for the Midwest on Biden's cabinet. What does it tell you?
It's quite the showing. And I think when you talk about Pete Buttigieg, yes, he is a former mayor of South Bend, but I'm not sure all of your listening audience knows that he is a new homeowner in Traverse City area.
I did hear that.
Yes. And so we have an incoming transportation secretary who's driving Michigan roads, who is driving between South Bend and Traverse City. So he knows full well the challenges we're facing in Michigan. I think that's only good for Michigan.
Right. Well, what kinds of sensibilities do you think that's going to put in the cabinet that maybe aren't there right now?
Well, you know, again, I haven't followed the cabinet that closely under the current administration, but it's been a revolving door. From what I've seen, just tangentially as a casual observer, a revolving door, a lot of acting secretaries of this or that. I'm not sure there's been the kind of commitment and the kind of stability to get things done that we need done in Michigan. So I'm certain that our current governor, Gretchen Whitmer, is pleased as punch at the nominations that will be coming out of the Biden administration.
Liz Boyd, former communications director for then Governor Jennifer Granholm, who is now Joe Biden's appointee for energy secretary. Liz, thank you very much for your time.
It's been a pleasure.
With us now for a deeper dive on the Granholm years in Michigan is Michigan Radio's program director and longtime politics watcher, Zoe Clark. Hi, Zoe.
Hey, April.
What were some of the major challenges that you saw Jennifer Granholm grapple with in office?
I mean, I think the biggest one that you can just kind of wrap up in a bow, and maybe I'm saying that it's because of the holiday season, but that was weathering the Great Recession and the fact that Michigan, home to the auto industry and what was then the Big Three, and this idea that economically, when the country catches a cold, the saying goes, Michigan caught the flu. And she had to weather those years with a state that faced billions and billions of dollars in budget deficits. And she was working with a Republican-led Senate at that point.
Would you say that there were issues that Granholm got wins on and others that probably she would even wish had gone differently?
Yes, absolutely. And again, I think all of that comes around to the fact that there were things that she came into office wanting to do. Childhood education, for one. Ideas about making sure that kids in this state got the best education possible and instead had to use much of the money that she wanted to put towards education to trying to get this state out of really what was just an economic disaster. I can't sort of explain enough what it was like day after day, especially in those years of just sort of hearing of hundreds and sometimes thousands of job losses, manufacturing job losses every single day through the state. It was a really dark time.
Zoe, we heard Republicans talking for years after Jennifer Granholm left Lansing about the lost decade. Looking back, how much of the blame do you think should fall on her shoulders?
You know, it's such a good but hard question, April. You know, anytime a governor has a good economy, they say it's because of them. And anytime they don't, they say it's because of the national winds. We saw presidents come through while she was in office talking about sort of bringing the economy back and taking credit for it. And Michigan was slow to that. So I'll leave smart economists to determine that exactly. But I think she was dealt a really hard hand of cards and didn't always play them well, which only made sometimes the situation even worse economically.
That was Michigan Radio's program director and certified politics junkie, Zoe Clark. When we come back, singer-songwriter Jeff Karub talks about filling the spaces in our day and the spaces between us during physical distance.
All the things coming at us this year, it's a blessing and a curse for creative types, you know, for songwriters, for artists. I don't know how this doesn't affect the art you make.
That's after a short break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. When you're at home, which for a lot of us feels like always, and you have a moment when you find yourself staring out the window, what are you thinking about? Maybe it's people that you miss. Maybe it's the job that you used to do. Maybe you're pondering your own seemingly endless boredom. Or maybe what's really getting to you right now is the utter weirdness of this year.
We gathered in the public hall for our weekly game of chance. Masks, they said, and separate at least 6 feet distance.
Detroit-based singer-songwriter Jeff Karub wrote this song, Bingo 2020, part dirge for the times before and part celebration for what's getting us through this moment. It's part of a collection of music he calls isolation hymns, freshly dropped for your pandemic listening. Jeff Karub, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You know, I think a lot of people might assume that this time would be absolutely golden for singer-songwriters because don't you all just love sitting in peaceful solitude, wearing warm clothing, drinking lots of coffee, and, I don't know, just contemplating? I mean, that's what you're doing all day, right?
It's overrated. yeah, it's like Groundhog Day, you know? There's all the... We're living through something. We're living through a lot of somethings, and I almost feel like it's, you know, a sensory overload. This 2020 was in so many ways. Never mind the pandemic. Ignore that little thing for a minute. Just all the things coming at us this year would be. It's a blessing and a curse for a creative types, you know, for songwriters, for artists. But yeah, I don't know how this doesn't affect the art you make. Good, bad, indifferent, I don't know how.
Seriously, how are you spending your time these days?
Well, I did. Okay, so I started a new job the day before the pandemic was declared.
No way.
I did. Yeah, March 10th, you know, and it was wild because I spent nearly 30 years as a traditional journalist. My last stop was at the Associated Press in Detroit. And after, you know, turned 50 last year, recorded an album that, you know, had me traveling a couple thousand miles, which for me is a big deal, to record with friends. And by year's end, I had that album done. And I had this job was looking good, but, you know, I had not yet started. And so I thought, yeah, 2020, you know, I'm going to play gigs to support the new CD, the new album, whatever form it takes anymore. And I'm gonna start this job. And I played my last gig in public a week before I started my job on March 10th, which was the day before the pandemic was declared. And so I'm writing at University of Michigan. I'm a public relations writer, specialist covering business and public policy and economics. And so I'm doing it all from home. Since about a week into the job, they said, go home. We all thought, oh, you know, a couple of weeks at home. I can do this. I know it's new, but I can do this. And here we are in December, still working from home.
I mean, it's great to be working right now, but did you find that you were dealing with a lot of isolation and maybe just like the destabilization of everything having changed so completely for you?
I think destabilization is a great word. You know, this whole idea of do it now, you know, when I turned 50, it sort of, I was hoping that would be the kickoff to the second half of this thing called life, as Prince said. So like everybody else, I mean, there was destabilization. It really is an apt word for everything that I was thinking and planning. And I saw the creeping loss. I saw people losing jobs. I saw people having their hours cut back. I was seeing people get sick and die in Detroit, especially in the early going of the pandemic. And you know, this stuff just can't not affect you. And thankfully, no one in my close circle has gotten COVID, but we all know that it hangs over us still, even with the great news of vaccines coming. So, you know, I can't imagine it not affecting everybody on at least a couple of levels.
So where did you want to take your writing practice, your songwriting practice, with all of that in mind?
Well, it was never the intention to create another collection this year. You know, I thought, I mean, the spigot never really turns off. I'm always writing. I'm jotting something down in a notes file on my phone, or if inspiration really strikes, I'm singing something into a voice memo. But yeah, in March, it really wasn't the intention to come up with isolation hymns. But after a song or two, there was an editor at a great website, Americana UK, who heard a couple of my early songs and said, you know, you can keep going, you know, you can make a whole album. I thought, I'm not going to do that. And we didn't know what Taylor Swift was up to at that point. We didn't know that, you know, people were doing this, but the songs kept coming. About one or so a month.
I wanna play, but the chords don't come. The words elude, it's an empty strum.
You know, there's a line in one of the songs, the one titled Lift to Reveal, that goes, I'm taking on faith that the block will clear, the cloud will lift to reveal the sun. What did you mean by that?
Well, that really turned out to be kind of the centerpiece or the main theme of the collection. I think at that point we were certainly a couple of months. We were a few months in, and it was kind of my ambivalent phase. You know, I was obviously hoping, like everybody else, that all the blocks, all the obstacles to something akin to normal would lift. But other lines in the song talk about the weight being hard, but, you know, so is the call to go. and I'm torn between leaving a mark and leaving no trace. You know, it was that ambivalent, that ambivalent feeling. But with that line that you quoted, it really is the idea that all of the blocks of 2020, the emotional ones, the mental ones, the physical ones, the ones preventing us from gathering, playing music in front of people, gathering with family and friends, my elderly parents, all of this, I really was just saying that with no proof yet, and really no idea when, I'm taking on faith that all of these blocks will clear, and the clouds kind of hanging over us, metaphorically speaking, will lift, and we'll see better days soon.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Jeff Karub, a singer-songwriter based in Detroit. He's just released a slew of songs called Isolation Hymns. You mentioned that you had just done this really epic trip to play and record with friends. And then there was this intense period of solitude. You know, for a lot of people, music, even if they write songs by themselves, it comes to be a very collaborative process and endeavor. Are there ways in which you have been able to continue what you think of as a collaborative spirit or collaborative process, even though we're all kind of stuck away from each other?
Yes, there have, and it's not ideal. It's you know, it's not playing in close quarters with friends on a stage, or in a community center, in a church, in a house. I love playing house concerts, and you really can't get more intimate than a house concert. And I always talk about that when I'm playing a house concert, how, you know, this is great because it's stripping everything away. There are no blocks. You're right there with your guitar, in my case, maybe the mandolin. And I'm with the audience, and they're really getting everything up close and personal from a couch or an easy chair or a folding chair. So what I've done, I've kind of leaned on friends, you know, confidants, collaborators, people that, I've played with music with before. So a lot of IMs, you know, sending people a file saying, hey, what do you think of this? I got a good friend, George Lucky, who just lives a block away. And so sometimes we'll see each other on the sidewalk. And he and I have done some playing together with another guy, a drummer, a retired Ford guy.
Yeah, we're past the point when you can be on the lawn or in someone's garage getting things done. But maybe next year.
Right. We did do, you know, in late summer, early fall, I did go into his garage and do some recording several feet away, next to a heater. I think we did employ the heater because it was one of those early fall cool days. So yeah, there's collaboration in a different, less ideal way, but there is collaboration. Nothing like being in the same room. But we do hope that comes in the new year.
There's a song called When the Days Allow Us, in which you write, I'd like to hope that we won't just go back to our old ways, when the days allow us.
What if we took time to grieve before we heave a sigh of relief? Maybe it's stepping forward with an attitude of gratitude to be alive.
There's been so much conversation about what could be different after the pandemic in terms of how we meet our community's needs, in terms of how we meet people's healthcare needs. What does it mean to you to say that you hope things don't go back the way they were?
Well, a lot of it might seem cliched right now, but the idea that we're not taking it for granted, if that isn't on all of our minds right now, it's certainly on mine. The idea that, you know, we're not just kind of muddling through or enduring what's happening, the slings and arrows of life. We're really appreciating it all in a way that we maybe didn't always before. And I mean, it really, I think it is just as simple as that, you know, we hear the phrase the new normal, and that can be kind of nauseating. But I don't want to just go back to, I want to know that the pandemic wasn't for naught, and that the social unrest and the racial unrest wasn't for naught, And we're somehow finding the things that that we have in common. I mean, if a pandemic can't unify you, I don't know what can. Aliens? You know, will it be? Is it Independence Day? I don't know. But I'm really hoping that, you know, we come out the other side with a greater appreciation for this and for each other, and we're gathering and not just muddling through.
I have that hope too. I suspect that there's still enough of the journalist still in you that you know that some of life's trials don't necessarily come with a payoff.
That's true. There's, I think sometimes I'm writing to convince myself of a better idea or a better way. And I always like to think that there's, you know, there's no 100% clear sky. That's not life. And, you know, if nothing else, you go into the next phase, clouds and all, hopefully fewer ones, but you're going in with the idea that I'm not going to take this for granted. I'm really going to try and live it and live it out. But no, I don't think you can be an observer of life, whether it's as a journalist, as I was for a long time, or really just, you know, eyes open in the world without having a sinking feeling that, okay, maybe it won't all be okay all the time. That's not the way it goes.
I think my favorite song in this collection is Bingo 2020.
Pandemic, earthquakes, wildfires, hurricanes, meteor, and Betty White expires. Protests, heat wave, and stocks collapse. Murder, hornet seed, Kanye West this year. Well, perhaps.
It's got a little gallows humor in there, and there's a line that goes, "When the games were done, some elbows bumped and others nodded at their friends. We're headed home and going to bed and looking forward to the year's end." You must be, I imagine that like a lot of other people, you're looking forward to the end of this year.
I really am. And that was the challenge, the half serious challenge of that song came from a friend of mine and a former editor of mine at the AP. Ted Anthony, who just called me up one day and said, "Hey, 2020 bingo. What do you think of that? What do you think of that as a theme for a song? You know, could you do something with that?" You know, for no purpose other than I think just the challenge of it. And I mean, within a couple hours, I had the words, and by the end of that night, I had the melody and the music, and I sent it to him. And I kind of thought of it, April, as this cross between Ring of Fire and We Didn't Start the Fire, and then
a call out song, yeah,
right. And then Ted said, "And throw some It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine" in there, and that's exactly it. I mean, you know, for being a little bit more on the novelty side, the line you quoted really is the human. It is the wistful part. You know, and we're not gathering to play bingo, but if we were, we would be elbow bumping, or we would be not touching at all. And then we'd be going home and saying, "Man, this is not the way I want to play bingo."
Yeah.
I want a better bingo.
For sure. This one's for all the church ladies out there and hoping for better things in 2021.
That's right.
I hope Ted gets his songwriting credit somewhere at the end of all this, too.
I'll just mention him as often as I can.
Okay. Well, Jeff, do you mind my asking, how do you think you'll spend New Year's Eve this year?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, there is a tradition. A very good friend of mine who is also still a journalist, I should say. I kind of still think of myself as a recovering journalist. We used to have a bachelor pad years ago before we found our wives and had kids. And we have gotten together for all but three New Year's Eves in 26, 27 years, almost 30 years. And one of the ones we didn't get together was Y2K, if you can believe it. And that was because I was working a night shift because we thought all hell might break loose, or maybe it wouldn't, but we had to be there just in case.
It seems so quaint now.
I know. Y2K. Oh, the damage done. It's like the lawn chair that falls over when we get, you know, the little rumble from an earthquake. And so I just talked to him, John, and said, "I don't know how we do this, man. I don't know if it's smart. You know, we can see the light at the end of the tunnel. The last thing we want to be doing is getting COVID when people are already starting to be vaccinated. So, you know, we're hoping that maybe there's a day over the Christmas, over the holiday break, in which it's just warm enough that we could have a fire and stand 6 odd feet apart and have a drink and toast this year, or toast next year. But if we don't, you know, we're just deciding that, there's going to be a great get together come spring, hopefully spring or early summer, where we just kind of recreate New Year's Eve. Maybe we'll pull up some videos of the ball drop or something, and we'll do it if we have to, whenever we can do it.
Singer-songwriter Jeff Karub, his latest collection of work is called Isolation Hymns. Jeff, take care and hang in there.
Thank you, April. It was great talking to you.
Arts and culture coverage on Stateside is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.
When's my time? I don't know. I could stay or I could go. I see we've lost great souls and minds. Roll the dice, can't close the blinds.
In just a few minutes, we're going to introduce you to the books of Devin Scillian. Newsman by day, children's author at all hours.
I think coming up with a successful and satisfying story is a better idea. And then a message tends to reveal itself, because that's what happens in satisfying stories.
That's after a short break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. There's plenty of interest in solar energy in Michigan. It's getting more efficient and cheaper, and utility companies have made ambitious renewable energy goals. But getting there will require miles and miles of land for solar panels. That could be a problem.
Everybody wants to put renewable energy where nobody can see it and in the middle of nowhere, but with renewables, location makes a difference.
To meet this need, the state's Department of Natural Resources is trying to develop solar projects on abandoned mines and other industrial sites. Lexi Krupp has more on where to put solar farms in Michigan.
When Jordan Roberts first visited the old gravel mine near Grayling, he thought it looked pretty fun.
If I were a teenager, I would just have so much fun on this gravel pit, because it's like this massive, like, sand dune.
The area is like a moonscape on Google Maps. It's been sitting there for years. Most recently, state police used the site as a shooting range. It's one of two properties the Department of Natural Resources offered to lease to solar developers. And Jordan got the state contract. He runs a renewable energy company called Circle Power. He thinks the site could generate enough electricity to power a few thousand homes. That's at the very least.
Hopefully we can do much better than that.
Right now, Michigan gets less than half of 1% of its electricity from solar. But new technology has made the industry competitive, even with the state's many cloudy days.
The cost of renewables has just plunged.
And many coal plants in Michigan are retiring. That's where the state has gotten much of its electricity in the past.
There is truly a transformation going on in the grid in Michigan, where some of these older technologies are being swapped out, and what they're being replaced with primarily is renewable generation.
But large-scale solar projects require acres of land. They can't just be anywhere. Solar farms need to be close to power lines and substations to connect to the grid. And these projects are not always welcome.
Sometimes people oppose renewable projects because they don't like how they look. Sometimes there's a lot of folks that look at things like farmland and they want it preserved as farmland.
So in the past year, the DNR started looking at the land they manage, millions of acres, for sites where there might be less opposition.
We're looking at those opportunities where we don't have trees, the soils may be degraded, it's not really productive land, and in some cases it's even polluted. And yet, a lot of times, solar is compatible on these contaminated sites.
Scott Whitcomb has worked with the DNR for over 20 years, and is part of the team working on this project. He says the department's first picks were the old gravel mine near Grayling and a former iron mine in the UP in Dickinson County.
From a Department of Natural Resources standpoint, these sites are no-brainers.
And these two properties are just the first. The state agency plans to offer another round of leases for solar projects next year.
We're in the process right now of taking a second look, maybe a much more detailed look, and trying to find some other sites that we can put forward to do the same thing.
Scott says for these two initial projects, local communities have been really supportive, in part because solar farms are a way to make the land productive. They would provide a few jobs and tax revenue. Max Meisner is the treasurer of Beaver Creek Township, the home of the old gravel mine. He's only heard positive feedback on the project so far.
I'm getting outreach from people saying, gosh, you know, I just heard about this. I'm like, okay, great, yeah, word's getting out. They're all for it.
But even with local support, there's no guarantee these solar farms will be built. Jordan Roberts with Circle Power says developing these projects is really hard.
In a best case scenario, we'd be 2 to 3 years away from building a project.
He still needs to get various permits, do environmental studies, and find a buyer for the power. He also needs to make sure the energy could actually connect to the grid. Despite all this, Jordan is cautiously optimistic about the prospects here. And solar advocates hope these DNR projects will serve as a model for other state agencies and landowners to develop their own solar farms.
That was Lexi Krupp from Interlochen Public Radio reporting. For many of us, the holidays are a time when we get to share our love for others through the pages of books. That includes for some of the youngest in our families. Christmas is an especially fun time to pick out picture books or remember our favorite early readers. And there are several treasured children's book authors Michigan lays claim to, well known for their classics. You might not realize that another award-winning children's book author has been disguising himself as Clark Kent every day while fighting for children's literacy and imagination in a less public-facing space. Devin Skillian is the nightly news anchor at WDIV in Detroit. He is also the author of several books in a series of memoirs for children, including his best-selling Memoirs of a Goldfish and this year's Memoirs of a Tortoise. And he joins us now. Devin Skillian, welcome to Stateside.
I have been told before that I bear some resemblance to Clark Kent. That's hilarious.
It's that lantern jaw, I think.
It must be it.
Devin, when did you know that you wanted to do this kind of writing?
Before I knew that I wanted to be a journalist, to be honest. My favorite school assignment, I think, of my entire life, I was in high school, and an English teacher assigned us to write a children's story. And I just loved it and found it so engaging, and so much so that when I got to college, I studied some children's literature and children's writing. And I think it connected me back to the books that meant so much to me when I was young, and that to this very day are still like these brothers and sisters that I carry around in my mind and memory. And so for a long, long time, I just dreamed of wanting to get one book published. I wrote my first story that ended up getting published about the year that Corey and I had our first child, when Griffin was born. And I thought that I had something pretty special in hand. It took 10 years, though, to get it published. And it was just one of the most thrilling things that ever happened. I had no idea at the time that there were 20 more books to come. But for a long, long time, April, I've known that that was something that I really, really passionately wanted to do.
You know, if people were surprised by the fact that you had this skill set, it actually wasn't that much of a shock to me, because anybody who's done news writing knows that the number one, one of the number one things that you have to be able to master is brevity and economy and bringing things across in a very vivid way very quickly. I mean, that's definitely something you also have to do with a children's book, right?
It's exactly right. I cannot remember exactly how many words Where the Wild Things Are is, but it's less than 300 words. It is insanely efficient and economical. And yes, that brevity is important. I still struggle with it all the time. Everything I write, when I look at the word count, I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. This is too long by twice, by double. But you're exactly right. The other thing I think that's duplicative is not just the brevity and being economical with words, but it's about storytelling. That's really good journalists not only impart information, but I think they tell stories. And so in those, in that sense, these are more closely related fascinations and occupations than might meet the eye.
I think the first few pages of Memoirs of a Goldfish really bring this across. Our protagonist here, the goldfish, could you sort of read us through the first 5 days of your narrative with him?
Sure. Day one, I swam around my bowl.
I'll narrate the illustrations. We have a very sweet-looking little goldfish in a very simple bowl that just has some pebbles in it.
Day two, I swam around my bowl. Twice.
He seems very pleased with himself.
Day three, I swam around my bowl. I thought about taking a nap, but fish don't sleep, so I swam around my bowl.
And there's just the slightest hint of uncertainty on his little fishy face right now that, you know, wondering, is there more to life than this?
Day four, I got some company today. I don't like the looks of him one bit. He doesn't say anything. He just bubbles.
Enter the little plastic diver decoration that we've seen in so many fish tanks, and our goldfish friend giving this dude a whole lot of side eye.
You're doing this very well, by the way, April. Very nice. Day five. Mr. Bubbles still hasn't said a word. He just looks at me. I said, hello, today. And he said, rrr. He's creepy.
So, Devin, through the gifts of your longtime illustrator, Tim Bowers, and again, this incredibly economical copy that you've written, we get chapters of the solitary life of a standard household pet and his extreme difficulty in dealing with change and unknown elements that are entering his fishbowl. I don't want to ruin the surprise for those who haven't seen the book yet, but I just wanted to ask a little bit about how the idea for this and how any of us adapt to change, how this came to you.
So many of my books, oddly enough, have started with a title. Once I get the right title in mind, for some reason, it seems to rev my imagination motor. And one day when one of my kids, my daughter Christian, came home from school, she looked at me and she said, Dad, I think there needs to be a book called Memoirs of a Goldfish. It came out of nowhere. And I just thought it was the greatest title that I'd ever heard. Memoirs of a Geisha had been out, you know, a few years prior, which we've had in the house. And my wife really liked that book, my wife, Corey. And when she gave me that title, then we all as a family kind of stood around the kitchen that night talking about the goldfish that we'd had before, a little fellow named Steve, who, I think everybody who's ever had a fish thinks the exact same thing. What in the world do they do all day? What is their reality? And once Christian gave me the title, the story came together very, very quickly. It was just a matter of days before I had it in my head, and then a little bit of tinkering over some time to get the words just right. But it just sort of all came together and in a really strangely satisfying way. And then Tim came along, and it was the first time that Tim and I had worked together, and I thought his illustrations were just magical. It was one of those things where I really thought that the whole was greater than the sum of the parts. And it was just kind of thrilling the way this one came together.
Your illustrator, Tim Bowers, he lives in Ohio and had a long career doing work for Hallmark, including their shoebox greetings. What do you like about his art style?
You know, Tim is extraordinarily gifted with creating emotion. In fact, you're talking about the side eye in the fish. I mean, who can create side eye in a fish? Well, Tim can. And one of the things that I learned really early on of working with Tim is when I'm writing, I need to leave Tim some space. I need to trust that I don't have to tell every part of the story, because Tim is going to take over and let his pictures tell a lot of the story too. And so it has been partnering with him, as we have now on a number of books. It's been just a real joy, because he's just so gifted at adding and not just duplicating what I'm saying, but finding ways to create more of the story than I even had.
Could you talk a little bit about how you and Tim collaborate with each other? Is it a question of you send him the copy and he sends you back some ideas, or do you talk things over at first and sometimes he feeds ideas back to you?
It's funny, I've worked with quite a few illustrators now, with the 21 books, I guess, with one that's being worked on right now. So they've all got sort of their own way of doing things. The guy named Mark Brought, who was the illustrator of a book of mine called Cosmos Moon, wanted to talk out every page with me, and it was really fun. And that was one kind of collaboration. Tim is the complete opposite. Tim gets the manuscript, and I really don't hear from him until he has basically a mock-up of the entire book, and all done in sketch form, so nothing's final yet. But I don't think I've ever asked for a change of any kind. Tim and I just kind of, I think we get each other. We've sort of got the same odd sense of humor, and it's a really interesting collaboration. But I kind of, and not that I'm comparing Tim and I to Elton John and Bernie Taupin, that would not be nice, but you know, the way that I've always heard the way that those guys work together is that Bernie would write all the lyrics and send them off to Elton, and he would put them to music. And that was, you know, just kind of, they both had sort of, they separated their church and state a little bit. And I think that's how Tim and I seem to work as well.
I imagine that while you spend your days at your regular job and spend a lot of your spare time working on this book, that there are moments when you find yourself in a bookstore. Maybe in pre-pandemic times, and you get a chance to look around a little bit and see what new titles are out there. What is it you think about children's books that are still capturing adults' attention?
No, there's just something magical, in fact, about books in general that we really can't quite duplicate in other media. If we all say, gosh, I love this movie or this TV show, chances are we're all experiencing sort of the same show. But if you have two people who come together and say, Prince of Tides is my favorite book, they have both read the same book, but they have both seen a different book. Their imaginations have populated it with characters who look and sound a different way than anybody else's version. And so in that way, books are so much more personal. The only thing I can think of that compares to it would be music. Because we fill in so many blanks along with the author. And so those books become really, really potent because we make them more potent to us. We personalize them. And I think in many ways, that's the way it is still with children's books. When I visit schools, I end up being in school libraries a lot. And I still, to this day, go look for My Side of the Mountain by Jean George, which was my favorite book when I was a kid. Now, I don't want to read it. I've practically got it memorized. I don't need to borrow it because I've got a copy here at home. I just want to touch it. I just want to know that it is still there, this book that meant so much to me. And if I close my eyes, I am right back inside that book with young Sam Gribble as he runs out into the mountains. And it looks exactly the same way to me today as it did when I first read the book, I don't know, probably 50 years ago. And that kind of permanence is something that is so magical to me about a book. To know that it's still there.
Devin Scillian is the nightly news anchor at WDIV in Detroit and the author of the popular memoirs series, including Memoirs of a Tortoise. Devin, thank you so much for this beautiful book and all the others, too.
April, it has been such a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We'll have more from Devin on his new book, Memoirs of a Tortoise, and his Christmas book, Memoirs of an Elf, next week on Stateside as part of our year-end look at the Year in Michigan Books. Just a quick note, tomorrow on the show, we'll be checking in with Congressmembers Fred Upton and Alyssa Slotkin about the potential of a COVID relief package out of Washington, D.C. before year's end. Please join us. That's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.